Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 806 on this Friday. It's August 20th, 45 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. We continue to see cooler temperatures for this morning, but we start to warm right back up as we expect to see plenty of sunshine. Unfortunately, we still have that patchy smoke out there that is leaving us with some moderate air quality. Tonight, we continue to see that smoke still hang around. It's stubborn. It does not want to move just yet. Looking at lows of 48 degrees for us tonight, and Saturday, we continue to see, again, that patchy smoke still hang around, but we have a little quick moving system that brings us some storm chances possible for the later part of the afternoon and evening time frame, and those showers slowly start to wane out into the overnight hours. We'll see a high of 71 on Saturday, low 49 for Saturday night. Sunday, we continue to see that we have temperatures hanging around the 70s. Sunshine will be plentiful, but we may start to see the return of some smoke as we have a little bit of a west-southwest flow overhead, and that should start to, unfortunately, bring a little bit of those heavier smoke plumes for us. So that's something to keep in mind as we go about the day. We'll see it will also slightly be a windy one for us. We'll see a high of 73. And then for Sunday night with clear skies, we'll see a low of 53. Monday, we continue the warming trend as we have plenty of sunshine once again. We'll see a high of 76 for us. And Monday night, we continue with those clear skies, and we'll see that it will lead us to a low of 53. Going into Tuesday, we're expecting to see plenty of sunshine once again. We'll have a high of 77. Tuesday night, we'll continue with the clear skies and a low of 54. Wednesday, we continue to still stay warm and sunny as we have plenty of zonal flow, giving us that nice little even kind of temperature that we continue to see. We'll have a high of 79. And going into Wednesday night with those clear skies, we'll see a low of 54. Going to Thursday, we're expecting to see another day of sunshine and warmer temperatures with a high of 79. From the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Over to you, Leslie.
Okay, Cesar. Thanks. Have a great weekend. Well, stay tuned. Coming up, we'll be checking in with Laura Smith with Mountain Trails. Later on, High Valley District Board Member Roger Armstrong will be in with an update on how that new transit system is operating. Park City Council Member Steve Joyce with a recap of last night's City Council meeting. And finally, Summit County's Public Lands Manager Jessica Kirby talking about lessons learned during the Parley's Canyon fire and what the county can help do to prevent future fires. On the phone first, I've got Laura Smith with Mountain Trails Foundation. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning. Good morning. We've got a little bit of a scratchy throat from all this smoke, but we are queuing up for a really great trails weekend. We've got some, aside from the smoke, which will hopefully sounds like be going away on Sunday, we've got some nice moist dirt out there. We've had some trails out to check the trails. Trail crews were out to check the trails. And they're estimating that by this afternoon, we're going to be good to go. So if you're out there, you do encounter a puddle, we're just asking you go slowly through the puddle, not around it, trying to keep that single track single. Basin Rec's Downhill and Grill was scheduled today for Trailside Park, but it's been postponed until next Friday due to potential wet, slick features and muddy conditions. And then we wanted to let everybody know, and the Quinns Junction Area Fire Command Center has been moved out, so Quinns Junction Trailhead is open, and it should be really great in Round Valley this afternoon. So hope everybody can get out and enjoy some great trails this weekend.
Yeah. Any updates with regard to the trails there in Summit Park? Last we had heard that those remain closed.
You know what? I would err on the side of staying away from that area. I have not heard personally what's going on out there, but it's still a sensitive area. So yes, stay away. We've got plenty of other trails on our trail system to visit this weekend.
Okay. Hey, Laura. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot, Leslie. Bye.
Well, the Blaine County Sheriff's Office in Idaho has not closed the search for Park City resident Fern Baird, who went missing while hiking in October of 2020, but there is still no active search for her. 62-year-old Baird was last heard from Monday, October 19th, 2020, when she signed into the Prairie Creek Trailhead north of Ketchum, Idaho. 3 years later, after she was reported missing, the Blaine County Sheriff Search and Rescue actively searched for Bear for 10 days, suspending the search after the search operation after one last major operation, though, was held in November last year, just before the snow fell. Blaine County Sheriff's Lieutenant Mike Abay told KPCW that there is no active search, and while the case does remain open, he says they have no leads to go on. Search and rescue teams did some training in the area this summer, he says, but they weren't able to find anything. While they may never know what happened, he says the likely scenario is that something happened while she was hiking, or that she got lost, bedded down, and then died of exposure. While there is plenty of wildlife in the area, he says they have nothing concrete to move forward with. He says there is definitely some difficult terrain in the area as well, and some spots that she could have fallen down depending on which way she went. Baird was known as Park City as an active community member who has spent years volunteering at local organizations. Her family was offering a $25,000 reward for information leading to her discovery. Again, if you have any updated information, you can contact the Blaine County Sheriff's Office at 208-578-3371. The High Valley Transit Board met recently, August 12th, in the studio with an update. I've got board member and Summit County Council member Roger Armstrong. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the meeting was to start with a presentation from Rachel Banstra, apparently a Valley Ride customer. What did she have to show the board?
She wasn't there. She wasn't able to make the meeting, so we rescheduled her. She was just going to share her experiences using the transit.
Okay, so we mean that she was a High Valley Transit rider.
Correct.
Okay. I mean, any idea of some sense of, I mean, good or bad? Or
I
you'll hear more.
It was I thought it was supposed to be a positive presentation, but again, I don't know. She wasn't able to make the meeting, so we didn't get anything.
Okay. So what kind of response is the board getting from riders?
So far, so good. I think the biggest complaint that we have is that the microtransit vehicles have New York license plates, and that's because we were in a rush to get vehicles in time to start in late June. The company is based in New York. It took some time, and now it's just a function of trying to get through the registration system with the state. It's been an issue just trying to get the vehicles registered, so they will be changed over, and as we get new vehicles in, obviously they'll be registered here as well.
Yeah, and a point that people have made is that residents only have 30 days legally to get their out-of-state license plates swapped to Utah plates, so why would it be any different for these folks?
Because, again, the state is having trouble processing it. It's not that we're failing to try and get the vehicles registered. It's that there's some hang-up at the state level.
The complaints that I seem to hear most about are that people can't trust transit to get them to work or an appointment on time, which I can imagine is terribly frustrating. Others, of course, saying, well, what do you expect? It's free, but still, that doesn't solve the problem of getting people where they need to be on time. So if transit is what the county is relying on in all of its new developments, then what needs to change?
Well, I think one of the challenges we have right now is labor. So if you look at the microtransit, I think we were promised 15-minute pickup times, and I think it's a little bit more than that. And the question that I asked in terms of what's causing those delays seems to be related to labor. It's like every place else. We're hiring, looking to hire more bus drivers and transit drivers. So if you're listening to this and you have any interest at all in being a driver and you can get the necessary licensing to do that, we need to hire more bodies. So that's part of the problem, is getting more bodies. I think otherwise, as far as I know, I've not heard complaints that our routes are running unduly slowly. We seem to have, you know, when I look at the numbers, total passengers in June were 6,348. July it was almost 12,000. And this is just on the micro. The percentage of rides shared in June was 30% on micro. Now it's in July it went up to almost 36%, so it seems to be increasing. We're getting increasing number of accounts. The reviews that I've seen seem to be that people is working well, so I'm not sure where the hang-up is in terms of people not being able to make it to work on time.
Yeah, I think it's the microtransit, so yeah, if you're not getting to the bus, Right, that's everything. Then you've missed your bus ride.
Yeah, although if you're not getting to the bus, MicroTransit takes you to whichever is quicker. If you're going to miss your bus, MicroTransit generally will take you to your destination. That's the way it works. So, again, I'm not sure where the hang-up was. Without more specifics, it's hard to respond.
Yeah. Just in terms of the labor, I mean, how many drivers are we short?
I don't know the number of drivers, but I think we're informed that the routes that operate earliest in the morning and latest at night are probably the ones that are most challenged. So drivers are going to pick the premium prime times. The biggest ridership that we have seems to be in the 1 to 7 p.m. range. 5 p.m. seems to be the most popular rider time for MicroTransit. So that 1 to 7 is where the biggest bump is. And I guess the question is, are the lower uses early in the morning and later in the evening, is that a function of fewer drivers to operate so that somebody is using some other form? That's something we're still trying to cook out. You know, we're 2 months into the micro, we're a month and a half into the overall transit. So far, wheels are staying on the buses, we're operating routes. Ridership is growing. The most popular destinations, you know, some people have questioned, I think you even raised the question, are we operating a free Uber service just from point to point? And the most popular destinations are Canyons Village Transit Center in Kimball Junction, and then it drops from there to Walmart, Westgate, the Olympic Park. Woodward is sixth down. There was a time when Woodward was slamming it. That was kids discovered that they could take MicroTransit and have that freedom. But I think we're building some more things. Bear Hollow, Waldorf, and Elk Meadows. When I see Elk Meadows on the list, that's very encouraging to me because it shows that, you know, some portion of the workforce is using this the way we hope that they would.
Yeah. Well, and as you know, when you were kind of joined at the hip with the Park City Transit System, labor was a huge challenge even then. And that's, I mean, offering, you know, good pay, benefits, yeah. Housing. I mean, we bought several affordable housing units for transit drivers. Summit County has kind of parceled that out to VIA then, mm-hmm. and Responsible. I mean, are they offering similar benefits to their transit workers?
We're going to have to dig into that and find out more. I don't know exactly what the benefits being offered are. I mean, they're offering benefits sufficient. We've got a good solid base of drivers. We just need to grow that driver pool.
Yeah, and you kind of rattled off those percentages, and I guess I just don't know what do those, I mean, what does 30% in June and 36% in July mean?
Well, those are the MicroTransit rides that have more than one person going to one destination. They're shared rides, and that's what we want to do is grow that MicroTransit so that it really is. This is the last mile solution. Remember, these are the areas that it's very difficult to get people to a transit hub, to a transit system. Some could ride bicycles, I suppose, but, you know, that's just not always the most convenient way to do it. So this gets people into the system. You know, in the Silver Springs area, there was some concern initially that they weren't going to have the same kind of access that they did. I don't think that's any longer a concern. But the additional benefit that we had was it opened up that trailside area that's adjacent to provide more access to transit to those folks. And I think that there's been substantial adoption of transit from those folks because of micro. So I think it's working. Again, it's early and you collect data as we grow and, you know, we'll make adjustments as we grow to fine-tune the system.
Yeah. There at last meeting was also a discussion about High Valley's Transit's vision and mission. Did you come up with something?
We did. You know, the vision statement is that idealized, aspirational look at where you want to be. And the vision statement for High Valley that was adopted is moving the Wasatch back forward with sustainable, innovative, and desirable transit. And then the mission statement is that how are we going to achieve the vision kind of statement, and that is through innovation and creativity. High Valley Transit provides safe, friendly, efficient, and easily accessible public transit solutions for the Wasatch Back.
Okay. Caroline Rodriguez was also appointed as executive director. So who takes over as Summit County's regional planner?
She's going to be fulfilling that role for a while, and we'll figure out who will slip into that position next. I mean, I think there'll be some overlap for a while.
Yeah, and she's okay with that?
So far.
Yeah, and so as executive director, I guess, I mean, what does that mean? You know, she's just running the district, all of the board meetings?
She's the day-to-day. She oversees the system. She troubleshoots. She's our liaison with VIA. She operates contracts. She oversees that grant process. You know, Transit these days operates very heavily on federal grants, and she's knee-deep in that. Acquisitions of new equipment, everything, soup to nuts. And she's, you know, when you look at her background, Caroline came to the county, and I didn't know a lot about her. She just kind of appeared on the scene and started working. And then you take a look at what she's done and where she came from. She's written white papers, really important white papers, that the industry relies on at very high levels. And she just understands this someplace deep within her soul that I'm not sure I ever want to go to. And I think she's a real treasure for us to have right now.
Yeah, so as you kind of look at your needs besides employees over the next year or so, I mean, what will that be?
Well, I suspect as we grow, you know, this is intended to be the first stepping stone in a regionalized system. So the way this regionalized transit works in the state of Utah is other jurisdictions want to annex into a regional system, is what you hope, whether that's municipalities, Wasatch County, how we start to put that system together. We need to start, and I think the council generally, not just in the world of transit, but I think the council wants to start looking at regionalization, and this is part of that infrastructure that is important to us. So we've already started conversations with Wasatch County about regionalization and how that would look on the transportation side, and those will continue, and those conversations will get deeper and more involved as we move along.
Yeah, so we don't get ourselves in the same situation as you found yourself in with Park City. Is it that Wasatch County, Heber City, or whatever, they need to have their own transit departments as well, and that we just kind of integrate them as opposed to Summit County doing all of the work?
Yeah, I don't think necessarily. I think, you know, when Park City and Summit County entered into the first agreement, Summit County was much smaller. Our transit needs were probably different than they are now. Park City was experienced and they ran it really well. And from an economic perspective, Park City had far more money to do it. Summit County had far less. And then the transit taxes enabled us to have more. And suddenly we started to look more equal and we had more needs because neighborhoods built out differently and we just had a higher demand. And it just didn't work for Park City to be in a position where they might have to share what works really well for them with another jurisdiction that might have some control to say, no, you shouldn't do that. We need to reallocate resources here. And that's going to be a challenge, you know, for any kind of regionalization, not just for transit. I mean, for housing, if we're going to do some sort of regional housing authority, that control issue is very much going to be an issue. And I think Park City decided that to let Summit County take the lead in exploring regional solutions, and Park City wanted to concentrate on what they do best here. And I suspect that we'll continue to work well with them. We have this connection down 224 that's critical. We have a connection through 248 that's critical, and moves that they make affect us and moves that we make affect them. So our staff continues to have conversations.
Yeah, so will we have those bus rapid transit lanes on 224 this winter?
I don't know we have the ability now, we have permission to do at least the shoulder running, so I think that will be happening. If it's not already, I think it will be happening. And then, you know, we're continuing to move toward getting that BRT lane finalized and pushed forward. That's a little further down the line.
All right, and then other plans in terms of gearing up for the winter? I mean, are we going to add more routes, just more buses? Or it's going to look a lot like it does today?
I think it looks a lot like it does today. I think we've got probably a few short months to solve the driver demand, the labor issue, and start adding more drivers to the system.
All right. And you had Joe Spink resign as he moved out of the district. Have you found his replacement?
We have not found his replacement yet, and I have to tell you, he's another surprising guy that when you dig into his background, he really had a great background for this. So we're sorry to lose him. It was personal reasons. He's moving and won't be able to participate. So we're going to look again. I think we'll open it again and start interviewing and see what else is out there. Fortunately, we live in a really wonderful community where if you start knocking on doors, you find people with remarkable experience and expertise that you didn't anticipate. And hopefully we'll have people that want to serve that have that experience and will help push us forward. I would like to say, you know, the fire that we just came through, I got a note from Caroline today. We were updating service on the websites the entire time. Our Valley Ride customers in the evacuation zones, we were contacting to make sure to see whether they needed rides. We had a wheelchair vehicle for emergency personnel to use for evacuations. We adjusted our service, and we also communicated. You know, I think you heard some of the mini debrief that we had at council Wednesday night talking about how we communicated and what groups we were able to reach, and really having now had that actual experience to step back and say, what did we do really well and where do we have holes? And we were communicating in English and Spanish through the transit district during that time to people. So I'm happy about that. That was a place where it worked well. And I think in other places, we need to take a look at how we deliver our communications.
Okay, Raj, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Leslie.
Roger Armstrong, a member of the High Valley Transit Board of Directors, also Summit County Council member. Park City Council meeting for the first time since mid-July yesterday in the studio with a recap. Councilmember Steve Joyce. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
This was the first council meeting since the Delta variant really began to surge. Are we back to virtual meetings for the foreseeable future?
We certainly were for last night. That was kind of a surprise. And I think we're going to have the discussion of do we switch them all back to virtual meetings. And I'm actually for that. I pushed a note out last night just suggesting that we go ahead and adopt that starting with our September 2nd meeting. I don't know what the rest of council feels, but I think, you know, it's coming, it's time, you can't ignore it, and we ought to be taking kind of a leadership role or an example, whatever you want to call it.
All right. During work session, council is moving forward with the xeriscaping incentives. So what kind of incentives do you think that the city is going to get the most traction out of?
I don't know. We've got an interesting thing here. We had a meeting down with the Weber Basin Water District folks, and you know, they were talking about how much easier it is to make changes in drought tolerant plantings and xeriscaping and all that if you catch developments as they're built. And the problem is we're mostly built out, you know, and so for us it's a very different thing of how do you get back to the people who've already invested and they already have landscaping and irrigation and everything and get them to completely redo it. My HOA is going through this right now, and it's extremely expensive to kind of rip everything up and come up with a different plan. So I don't think we know what the answer is. I think we just have to recognize that it's not new development. It's really going back in and finding ways to either help or incentivize whatever the folks who already have a landscape but have to tear it out and make it better.
Yeah, I mean, can you see some kind of big native plant sale or something that if the city's doing it, that everybody could get a little bit cheaper prices?
Yeah, I had thrown out the idea of just, you know how we did that solar purchase where, you know, it wasn't just the purchase of the panels, it was also the installation and stuff. I was wondering if there's something like that. But part of the challenge right now is it's almost impossible to get landscaping work right now. I mean, it's like everything else. Even if you are going to throw your money at whatever your current need is, getting humans to do the work is a real challenge. So I'm not sure we could put together any kind of program like that. Obviously, for plant sales, you probably could. But our lesson is that a lot of the costs are irrigation cost when you move from like spray to drip and things like that, more than the pull out one bush, put in another.
Yeah. Let's see. Public Improvement Districts, known as PIDs, also discussed yesterday. It didn't sound like the council was all that enthusiastic with the idea for Park City. You and Councilmember Tim Henney both questioning how relevant the concept is to Park City with the Park City Mountain Resort Base and Deer Valley Snow Park lots, really the only two big private developments on the horizon. So is there a scenario where Park City could benefit from a PID?
Yeah, I mean, just for what it's worth, PIDs are, you know, public improvement districts. And so what they're normally used for is development incentive. So, you know, there's a lot of places who are like, oh, you know, we've got this 1,000 acres out here and we would love to have it built out with residents and commercial and all this stuff and improve our tax base. And we're like the opposite. We're like, no, we have enough. Can we dial it back as much as we can? And so the only way a PID really works for us, because what it really is a finance mechanism that makes it cheaper for the developer to borrow money. So the only way that it makes any sense for us is if, you know, the developer had some huge community value give back as an exchange for this, because the city doesn't have to provide this kind of financing. It's not our money. We're just kind of a go-between. But the city doesn't have to provide a PID. So there would have to be some huge community value for us to justify it with our needs. Normally, it would go into something like if you had that 1,000 acres. Oh, well, this will pay for the sewer and the water and the, you know, power and all that. Yeah, we don't need that.
Yeah, so the city does have to approve PIDs before a developer could take advantage of it within the municipal boundaries?
Yeah, it's literally the developer comes to the city and the city has to be the one to, you know, approve it at the first level. Then the developer as a landowner has to approve it as well.
Where do things stand, though, with, like, the homestead? Because we're talking about doing a public-private partnership there.
Yeah, I don't think it fits there. I don't think we have that kind of a financing need. You know, in general, anybody developing in Park City right now can borrow money. We can borrow at a municipal rate if it's us. The challenge is if you're a developer borrowing money, you borrow at a higher interest rate. And so that's how they would, being able to borrow at more of a municipal rate would help them.
Okay, so we're just saying let's not make it any easier.
Yeah, the real answer is going back to Deer Valley and anybody else who wants to request this kind of thing, bring us a proposal and know that the bar is really high.
All right. Council returned to the Gordo site, again, where a soils repository was proposed, and I guess deciding to more or less abandon the plans for that soil management facility?
Yeah, I think it was pretty clear from the meeting that we had, whatever that was, 4 weeks ago or something, that the community simply has no appetite for that out there at all. You might have heard a little bit. I think it's unfortunate how that really came to be. And I think some of the angst and the worries that people had were from misinformation. But nonetheless, I think the answer is it's done. We won't be building a soils repository out there. We told staff to stop that work. And so now we get the question of, can we start having discussions with the EPA again? I don't have a lot of hope in that because I don't think anything has changed since this was done 3 years ago and 6 years ago and 10 years ago. And, you know, it's the same old, same old. But the other thing is we have to start thinking about how we're going to get rid of that 35,000 cubic yards of temporary soil. And we need to start thinking about, even if the Arts and Culture District is on hold for now, I mean, we're going to do things like tear up Park Avenue, build Homestake. I mean, there's a lot of other projects that have pretty serious soils impacts, and it's going to make them a lot more expensive.
Yeah, so the permit before the Utah Department of Environmental Quality will be withdrawn, effectively
yes,
killing the project. And
yep,
again, you expressed some disappointment yesterday at how the process went down and had hoped that the saved money, we're talking like $17 million over 10 years, could have gone towards things like transit or affordable housing instead. So if you could do it over, I mean, what would you change?
I would certainly have been a lot more proactive at the council, at the city level early, where we had meetings and they really didn't get a lot of attention. The answer is we should have been doing a lot more outreach. We should have been pushing out a lot more education into the public. even though I think it's been done more than a lot of people realize, I would have gone back and done yet even more soils testing. I mean, Mark Fisher did a lot of them. We did a lot of them. But I would do even more of them, just, you know, knowing how much misinformation was going to be pushed back. I mean, telephone calls that people got, the text messages people got, some of the things that were spoken in the sessions that we had were just fundamentally wrong. And I look and I go, I think some of that's our fault for not having gotten out in front of it. So hopefully there's a lesson there that we can absorb for future issues. But this one's past us.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it just sounds like, I mean, people would rather have the stuff everywhere rather than in a contained, safe site.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure what it is. I think people are literally just in almost kind of it kind of built into almost a frenzy of worry about toxic soil's going to kill my children and whatever. And it's like, you've been living in and amongst this. We've probably had 50,000 dump truck loads go through town. No one's died, no one's sick, no one's, this isn't different. This is actually safer. But the answer is, no, people would rather spend the money. And
Councilmember Max Dorney suggested that this may not have been that big of an issue if it hadn't been an election year. Do you agree with that?
I won't go too deep into that, but yes, I definitely think that some of the things that were driving some of the misinformation were done in the mindset of affecting the election.
You said, I mean, going on from here, going to renegotiate or perhaps with the EPA or another alternative, look at how we get that 35, million cubic yards?
Thousand. Thank God it's not million, but yeah.
35,000 cubic yards of soil. I mean, do we just have to suck it up and pay to have that hauled out to Tooele?
I'm guessing that's going to be the answer. I don't see Richardson Flat opening up. I don't necessarily understand. I think it was Becca who mentioned, it's like, you know, as much as the community has had issues with what we were going to do at Gordo, picking it up from Gordo and moving it over to Richardson Flat doesn't really make a lot of sense. It's actually not going to be as safe there as it was across the street. So it may be going out to Tooele at the expense of, you know, probably about $10 million.
Yeah. And again, I mean, Mark Fisher says he would have never bought that property where the art and culture district is proposed if it had had bad soil on it. So do we really know that there's waste that needs to be hauled from there? I mean, we keep hearing the $17 million, but if there's no dirt there, then there's not a problem. It can just stay where it is.
If you've moved it to there, which they did to dig the tunnels and everything, it's got to go somewhere. I don't think they're going to let it sit. Actually, the EPA might be happy if we just turned around and did all the right stuff to cap it. It already is capped, but we would probably have to do some ongoing testing and that kind of thing. But again, I just don't know how to turn back to the community that thought that was going to cause lung cancer and tell them that we're leaving it there. But it would be just like the pile over in Park City Heights, and it would be just like the pile up by the Montage, and it would be just like the pile over here at the Old Town Transit Center, and I mean, you can go on and on. But those don't seem to bother people.
Let's see. You started a discussion with Park City Police Chief Wade Carpenter about the truck enforcement and brake checks happening on Marsac Avenue, again, following that really horrific dump truck crash last month. It sounds like the state legislature tied the city's hands when it comes to our options here.
Well, a little bit. But, I mean, what it really comes down to is that the trucking, managing these trucking things is normally a highway patrol responsibility. So they have small teams for kind of north and south Utah to go in and do these truck inspections. We're actually unusual that when we had one of these truck incidences a couple of years ago, we actually got one of our police department members trained and everything and certified. There's a long list. And then the highway department actually donated pretty expensive equipment to do all these inspections. As far as I know, I think we have the only municipal policeman who can actually do these truck inspections in the state. But there are some legislative changes they've made to not do inspections for trucks weighing between 10 and 26,000 pounds. They used to have to do that. So now we can't even, you know, kind of have the same restrictions that we used to. So it's kind of awkward.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about the economics need to change, suggesting increasing fines so high that the cost of properly maintaining the trucks would be cheaper than having to pay the fine?
Yeah. I mean, right now, if all you get is a slap on a hand kind of thing, you know, a slap on the wrist, it's like, okay, so you lost 3 hours of work and you got a warning. So what? That's easier than fixing your trucks, you know. But if the answer is every time we basically hauled your trucks off and you lost them for a couple of days and then you got hit with a multi-$1,000 fine, guess what? It'd be cheaper just to keep your trucks repaired. And so,
can the city actually set its own fine schedule?
No, unfortunately, that's a state thing. So we are working with the state not the legislature yet, but working through the Utah Highway Patrol and the safety folks at the state level. The one thing that Dave Thacker came back and said that we can do, which is kind of a different slant at this, is if we have guys that are failing their truck inspections on these construction projects up in Empire Pass, which is where most of this work is being done, we can go in and shut the construction projects down for some number of days as part of our construction mitigation plans. And so that's kind of a level of indirection where you had a truck driver who's probably for some subcontractor, not for the actual developer, and you're punishing the developer. But at some level, you do that enough times, and that subcontractor either goes out of business, or no developer wants to hire them, or they start passing back the cost to the truckers. And that's actually within our role. So I think we can start doing that more aggressively.
All right. City Manager Matt Dias said that this is a top priority for staff, and he'll report back in 6 weeks. So I guess what would you like to see in 6 weeks?
Just there's a lot of things that sound good, but they may or may not result in anything. Like when we're up there talking and we're having, you know, making emergency requests to the Utah Highway Patrol Department, well, that's the right step, and they seem really interested and we're having good meetings. But the question is, did anything come out of that? And so, I mean, that's really going to be where the rubber meets the road is, are we actually getting any response at the state level? We always do. Every time one of these happens, there's always kind of this flurry of activity. And some things are lasting, like having the officer here who's trained to do these truck inspections. That's a lasting thing. But a lot of the things aren't. There's kind of a frenzy of education and stuff like that. And then it kind of dies off until the next one.
Okay. Finally, council approved $300,000 for wildfire mitigation there on the Treasure Hill property. Still fire season, so does that start right away?
That's going to start as soon as we can get the company out there. They're doing a lot of other work. I think Heinrich's expectation is that's probably early August, October. But that would be good leading into next year is if we can get that moving. It's a multi-year project to get up there and plan that out and start clearing that out.
So is that an annual expenditure then, or just...
I think it's going to be an interesting discussion, and I would encourage everybody, especially with the fire that just happened, to get involved with this, because to really make an impact around the community, you know, that's just for Treasure Hill. You start looking at all the land the city owns, all the open space, and then start throwing in Deer Valley land, United Park City Mine land, Talisker land, that kind of thing. This is a big, long-term, expensive change in behavior, and we haven't been doing it, and it's going to be hard, I think, for the community. It's going to be hard for financially for the city, but I think everybody's got to step up to this. We just saw the reality of it.
That's going to lead greatly into my next interview with Summit County's public land manager. Steve, anything else you wanted to add?
Just one quick one, which is we had 2,500 people vote in the primary. I thought that was great, but we had 68 people who submitted their ballots too late, and they were postmarked too late. It's like, it irritates me that people don't vote, but when you take the time to figure it out and vote, for God's sakes, put that either in a Dropbox or get it in early. You sat on it for 2 or 3 weeks before you mailed it in. We lost 68 people's votes just because it was postmarked late. So
You made it really easy. It was a drop-off. Actually, it was the box was outside the Marsec building. You didn't have to get out of your car.
Yeah, and there's one over at Dan's. I mean, they're all over the place. It's like it's not hard. Or you can just mail it in 2 days before you did, and you'd be good. So, please.
Okay.
Thanks.
Steve Joyce, Park City Council member. Thank you. Well, Jessica Kirby has been hired by Summit County to serve as its first public lands manager. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Leslie.
So before coming to Summit County this year, you served in a very similar role for the Snyderville Basin Recreation District?
Yeah, that's correct. For the last 5.5 years, I've been with Basin Recreation as the open space management supervisor, doing a lot of the similar work that I'll be doing at a larger scale for the county.
Okay, so talk to us a little bit about the position that you have with Summit County. I mean, what is it that you will be doing?
Yeah, sure. So the county really recognized the need that they were short-staffed and they didn't have the capacity to deal with a lot of these issues that we just recognized with the fire. And so a lot of my work will be dealing with mitigation projects. A lot will be dealing with just mapping and taking inventory of the lands, both agricultural protection lands, conservation easement lands, and any fee title lands that we have as open space. And working with the U.S. Forest Service and the capacity to do some larger landscape scale projects that have kind of had hands tied when it comes to boundaries. So we're going to call those cross boundary projects. And then, working with the water districts, taking inventory of our water rights, just a lot of things that have just not had a lot of attention lately at the county level.
You're right. So it sounds like we're just starting with the county-owned property or open spaces. And so when we start to talk about the Forest Service property, that's really kind of the next level.
Yeah, really one of the projects that spearheaded this whole thing was it's a project called the Weber Watershed Protection Project. It is something that the county, the U.S. Forest Service, Basin Rec, and the World Resource Institute has been working on with Mountain Regional Water to come up with a plan to protect the upper Weber watershed. And through that process, the county really realized that, they needed a project manager for that and someone to collaborate with all the different multi-partners. It's going to be a lot of public-private partnerships, working with the state and the federal government to get grant funds and actually to build a resilience fund for our county. So one of the things that I've been tasked with is to create a pool of money that, just like Steve was saying, he nailed it on the head. This is a big change in behavior. This is something we haven't been doing, and we don't have the budgets for this. And so building a resilience fund is part of the task that I have on hand.
Yeah. So what are we protecting the watershed from?
So, catastrophic fire. We have spent the last 100 years not allowing fire to go through, and so that allows for a lot of fuel buildup. Once a fire comes in to a watershed, and we saw it with these rains that came in right after the Parley's Canyon fire, you can have large mudslides. Fortunately, in this situation, we don't have an immediate stream that can be clogged up with the Parley's Canyon, but if a similar fire were to happen, say, at the Rockport Reservoir area where our intake is for our water system, it can cause significant damage to the infrastructure and impact the downstream water and our local communities' waters, ag, and our fresh drinking water.
Yeah, it was while you were working for Basin Rec that you were working on a forest health and fuels reduction project in Summit Park. During that time, you put up with a lot of criticism. There was a petition protesting the work that was being done. I mean, I know you don't want to say, I told you so, but you told us so.
Yeah, that's a tough one. What I can say to that comment is wildfire, it's a real risk for our community. And, while there are varying opinions on how we can mitigate that risk, protecting life and structure and keeping our forests and our watershed healthy is really a big priority for our county and was for Basin Rec when I was there. And we really wanted to demonstrate to the community what it's like to be a good steward of land and to show them that by doing mitigation work, it's not clear cutting. It's, you know, you can go up to Summit Park where we did the treatments, and had you not been familiar with the area, you might not even notice we did the work. So there's little steps that you can take to help protect, you know, not only the forest, but the structures nearby.
Yeah, and I recall that one of the criticisms was that with the trees that were cut, erosion control was going to be a huge problem. Did you see that at all happen?
No, we haven't experienced any of that, especially, and we've been tested a few times with the storms that have come through this this summer. You know, it's not a concern. We did not devegetate the area. There is still root systems in the ground that is holding the soils together. And, you know, ironically, some of the logs that get felled in these situations are laid down on the surface of the open space to mitigate any possibility of erosion. But like I said, we didn't do a soil disturbance. These were hand crews that went through. It wasn't machines roughing up the dirt. And so there was very minimal soil damage, which would cause erosion in this case.
Yeah. And I think that the project entailed, what, about 200 acres?
Correct. Yeah, so that was phase one. We did about a little under 200 acres. And this year, actually starting next week, the district is slated to do phase two of the project, which will complete the treatment in Summit Park. It'll be additional roughly 200 acres again.
All right. And so this work is being done and paid for then by Basin Rec? How come?
You know, it's a combination of the Basin Rec operational funds and a grant that was secured through the Utah Watershed Restoration Initiative, which is a state grant that is applied for once a year to do mitigation work like this. And so it is on the shoulders of Basin Rec because they own the property, but it has been supplemented with those grant funds from the state. And those funds come from sportsmen's groups around Utah, and the U.S. Forest Service put some funds into that, and then the state stewardship and shared stewardship program puts funds in there as well.
Yeah, so you're going to be doing something similar then with the county's open spaces and things like that?
Yeah, correct. So right now, like I said, we're going to focus on the Upper Weber Watershed Project. That's a project we've been trying to get this resilience fund put together for. But the goal of this project is, you know, to focus on the Weber and then to extend beyond the boundaries. And then alongside it, we've been partnering with Park City Municipal. They've been doing a lot of work with their fire and mitigation efforts. And we'll participate with any willing landowner that is looking into to getting help for mitigation. We can, you know, part of my role is to collaborate and get contacts to help people get the information they need to get in contact with the WUI coordinators at the state level, or, you know, to get some grant funds to do work. So happy to have the public reach out to me, especially HOAs that have matching funds that can bring to the table. You know, this is a really ripe conversation to have right now, and I know everybody's really likely scared and eager to start doing some work on the ground.
Yeah. So if the kind of work that was done in Summit Park was done in the area of the Parley's Canyon fire, would it have made a difference just given how dry it is out there?
You know, it's kind of rolling the dice. You know, you never know what you're going to do if the fire behavior is going to match the mitigation that you've done. But I strongly feel that yes. And actually, the area that did burn was slated to have some mitigation work done this summer. That was part of phase two of the Parley's restoration project that the Summit Park piece has been funded for. So, you know, that area was already identified as a possible ignition spot. And had they had the chance to do the, you know, remove the brush in that area, it likely would have slowed it down and given the firefighters an upper hand.
And certainly as one of those who was evacuated in the Parley's Canyon fire, does it give you any kind of different perspective as you kind of go into this new position?
You know, wildfire has been a part of my life for a long time. You know, 18 years ago, I lost a home in one, and it to be evacuated again brought up a lot of emotion, and it doesn't change my opinion of the fact that, you know, we are part of this and management needs to happen when you take away the natural process. I am a strong advocate of managing our forests, and that doesn't change, especially with, you know, having my family this time, you know, the first time I was in my 20s, this time I had two kids and a family, and, you know, really was going to lose more. So it was sobering. But it definitely gives me, for lack of a pun, fire to keep going.
Yeah. All right. Well, best of luck to you in the new job. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
That's Jessica Kirby. Again, she's been hired by Summit County to serve as its first public lands manager.